Modern scholarship has done much to dash the overly romanticized popular image of the Crusades. Once depicted as utterly pious causes conducted by valiant knights, we are now willing to question the mixed motives of popes and crusaders and to be horrified by the too frequent incidents of senseless slaughter. Of all the Crusades, few are more disturbing or less understood than the Albigensian Crusade, a crusade that, beginning in 1209, took place not in the Holy Land, but in France. With us today to discuss the course and legacy of the Albigensian Crusade is Mr. Stephen O'Shea, author of The Perfect Heresy, The Revolutionary Life and Death of the Medieval Cathars. Hello, Mr. O'Shea.
Hello, Eileen.
Who were the Cathars, and why were they known as Albigensians?
Well, the Cathars were dualists. They were heretics. They were members of the most successful Christian heretical movement of the Middle Ages. They were known as the Albigensians because many of them were centered around the town of Albi in France. Now, the countryside around Albi is called, in French, the Albigeois, but in Latin, it's Albigensian. So it was thought that the Cathars' biggest stronghold was around Albi, but in fact, they were in the Languedoc, which is the southwestern France. They were in the Rhineland, and they were also in Italy. But they were strongest around Toulouse, Albi, and Carcassonne.
You mentioned that the Cathars were dualists. What does that mean?
The Cathars believed that there were two gods. One was good, one was evil. The evil god had created the world and everything in it. So the evil god, in fact, was the god of the Old Testament, God the Creator. The good god was someone beyond the evil god, the all-powerful god. So our life here on earth was hell. We were going through the hell of material existence before joining the good god. This is an old tradition of dualism. It's in classical times. It was expounded by the Gnostics, who were also Christians and Jewish as well. There were Manichaeans, which is a pagan sect, which believed that there was a good and evil god. And then there were Christian sects throughout the first millennium of Christianity, who also were dualists. It just so happened that the Cathars were dualists at a time when Western Europe was undergoing a religious reawakening in the 12th and 13th century, and they became very successful.
What about Catharism made the Catholic Church very nervous?
One was its success. Catharism had completely infected the nobility and the merchant classes of a very important province of Christendom, Languedoc. And secondly, Catharism said that the church itself was illegitimate. It said that the church was worshiping the wrong god. So the Cathars weren't reformers. There were a lot of reformers in the Middle Ages. The Cathars were saying, you are worshiping the creator god. Your churches, your vestments, your wealth is proof that you are evil. So, in fact, the Cathars were diametrically opposed to the church. So they were the enemies of the church. And the church, seeing its legitimacy questioned, naturally reacted against that.
The title of your book refers to the Cathars as the perfect heresy. Why so?
Well, the Cathars, the holy men and women of Catharism, were called the perfect in the sense that they were perfected heretics. They had gone through the stages of initiation. Now, what happened in the Cathar Creed, there were two classes of believers. There were the perfects, who were ascetic, who renounced sex, meat, all worldly goods. And it is thought that they would rejoin the good god at their death. The regular believers would be reincarnated time and time again until they were ready to become one of the perfect. The Cathars were also the perfect heresy because it was perhaps the most absolute heresy. If you think, when you give a normal Christian creed, I believe in God the Father, God the Son, God the Holy Spirit, usually a heretic will disagree somewhere in the second or third paragraph and say, wait a second, no, I don't agree with the church, I don't agree with that. The Cathars, you couldn't even get past the first phrase, I believe in God the Father. They'd say, no, sorry, that's not right. So that they were perfect heretics in the sense that they were the most absolute heretics. And, of course, they were perfect heretics without the article. I was going to call the book Perfect Heresy because the Cathars were perfect heresy to the powers that be of the Middle Ages, to the church and the established feudal nobility.
Well, along with what was happening with the church at the time, you also bring into the story the political situation in the area at the time. What was the political situation in Languedoc?
Languedoc is interesting. It was a fractured feudalism, you could call it. There were several families that controlled large lands. In other words, there was the Saint-Gilles family of Toulouse, which formed the Counts of Toulouse. There was the Trinquevel family of Carcassonne, which controlled central Languedoc. But at the time, there were also merchants in the growing towns. Toulouse was the third largest town in the Latin West in 1200, and they were wresting power away from the nobility. Now, you have to remember, Languedoc was not a part of France. Languedoc had its own language, which is a Provençal tongue. It was more allied to Aragon, to south of the Pyrenees, than it would be to Paris. There was competition. It was also a very wealthy area, trading throughout the Mediterranean world. One of the members of the family of the Saint-Gilles family was a king in the Crusader states on the other side of the Mediterranean. So there was intense competition between church merchants and these petty feudal nobles for wealth and influence in Languedoc, which, since there was no central authority, a heresy like Catharism could grow because there was no one to suppress it.
What was the general religious atmosphere of the early 13th century?
Well, it was exalted, one could say, because the 12th century had witnessed a spiritual renaissance in Europe. There had been the founding of the Cistercian order, which was a leaner, meaner version of the Cluniac and Benedictine monks. There were the Crusades, there were the Knights Hospitaller, the Knights Templar. There had been several heretical movements throughout the 12th century. With the reawakening of Europe, the growth of the towns, people were beginning to question established religion. They were looking for a faith that was more personal. So it was a very exalted time in Europe, and especially in southwestern France, rather in Languedoc, because they were a generation or two ahead in development than the rest of Europe.
And how had the Crusades been going lately?
Bad and ugly. Around the year 1200, several terrible things had happened from the church's point of view. One was Saladin, the great Kurdish leader, had retaken Jerusalem in 1187. So the whole point of the Crusades, the whole stated point of the Crusades when they launched them, was to take Jerusalem. Now they had lost it, 1187. Another crusade was organized to take it back, which was the famous Third Crusade with Richard the Lionhearted. He failed to take it back. Then, in 1204, there was a rather shocking crusade, the Fourth Crusade, in which the Christians from Western Europe sacked the Christian city of Constantinople, the greatest city of the Mediterranean. They were turned away from their objective, and out of frustration, they committed the greatest act of vandalism of the Middle Ages, sacking Constantinople, the head of the Byzantine Empire. The sack lasted 3 days, and they carted off tons of treasure, and it was a sack from which Constantinople never recovered. So the Crusades had been discredited to some people.
And thus far, we've been talking about Crusades in the Holy Land or in Constantinople. How did it come that a Crusade would be launched against people in the West?
Well, the Pope who was responsible for it, Pope Innocent III, he was probably the most powerful Pope of the Middle Ages, and he sort of had an all-directional idea of Crusades. He was launching a Crusade in Spain against the Moors. He had launched this Crusade to the Holy Land, and the idea of crusading was not foreign to him, and he saw that he believed that these heretics were not Christians. Heretics are not Christians, they're heretics. So therefore the idea of crusading was central to Innocent's worldview, and also he convinced the knights of France, of northern France, that they would be able to take over the rich country of Languedoc if they took part in this crusade. So there was a material bribe there.
And how was it apparent that this was going to be a new kind of crusade?
Because the scale of the Crusaders didn't usually slaughter Christians or even slaughter Catholics. The first act of the Crusade in 1209 was the wholesale slaughter of the city of Béziers, which contained about 20,000 people. It's assumed that perhaps one-tenth of them were Cathars. So the Crusade, almost genocidally, just wiped out the entire town, including 19,000 Catholics. So this was obvious, the scale of the cruelty of Christian towards Christian would be unprecedented. And then afterwards, we may jump ahead, to hunt down the survivors of this 20-year war of terror, the Inquisition was founded. Now, the Inquisition lived on, but the idea of a thought police that invaded, that completely invested an area to root out any dissident, that was also a result of the Albigensian Crusade.
You just said that they also killed in Béziers 19,000 Catholics. I mean, how could they justify doing that?
Well, there's an apocryphal story about it. The leader of the Crusade, when they first breached the walls, he was supposed to have been asked, he was a monk, he was supposed to have been asked how they could, what the Crusaders should do, how they could distinguish from Cathar, between Cathar and Catholic, and he was supposed to have responded, "Kill them all, God will know his own." Now, whether he said that or not, I mean, the result is the same. Obviously, they, basically each year of the Crusade, 1209, 1210, 1211, etc., they started with a signal act of brutality and terror. This was the first act of the Crusade, the first act of the Crusade. So when this monk, Arnold Amory, wrote back to Pope Innocent about killing 20,000 people, most of them Catholics, even Pope Innocent thought that the Crusade might be going a bit too far.
How completely were the Cathars wiped out in the end?
Almost entirely. The last holy man, the last perfect of Languedoc we know, was burned in 1321, and then a couple of generations afterwards, the Cathars of Italy, of northern Italy, were wiped out, where they were more successful in Languedoc, I should say, the Catharism, but Italy, they remained a small sect until the end of the 14th century. So the Catharism was completely exterminated, and then in subsequent centuries, calumnied by Catholic historians as something that it wasn't. You know, there was all sorts of rumors about them being cat worshippers, about very weird practices of the Cathars. It's only in the 19th and the 20th centuries has it emerged that the Cathars, in fact, were this pacifist, tolerant, live and let live medieval Christian religion.
We only have a few moments remaining, but why should we, in the 21st century, remember the Albigensian Crusade? I mean, what is its legacy?
Well, its legacy, for one thing, it's Catharism is the road not taken. It, as I said, it represented a form of Christianity and a form of social organization that was entirely different from the sort of monolithical, repressive model that unfortunately came to be in the 13th and 14th century. It's also instructive in modern day to see the Church's reaction. The Church's and the French King's reaction is sort of a template of the totalitarian state. And we can see the origins of that in the Church's reaction to Catharism with the Inquisition. It's also interesting to think, if we like to think of what-if history, what if France had not taken Languedoc? There would have been an entirely different country stretching from perhaps Nice all the way down to Barcelona, a different land, a different cultural entity. The history of Europe would have been changed. And finally, it's just a story that has been ignored or distorted for too long, and sort of we owe it to memory somewhat to remember the Cathars, and not as romanticized heroes, which is the case among many Europeans of the counterculture. The Cathars have become many things, sort of proto-hippies. But we just should remember they were obviously a very brave, a very holy, and a very unfortunate group of people.
Right, well, thank you very much, Mr. O'Shea.
You're welcome.
We've been talking with Mr. Stephen O'Shea, author of The Perfect Heresy, The Revolutionary Life and Death of the Medieval Cathars.